KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Noe Valley.
Napa, California.
I live in the Castro.
Fillmore District.
Bernal Heights.
Oakland, California.
Coming up, the world's largest conference for game developers is in town. But some women don't feel safe at the nighttime parties.
I was starting to look at what parties I could sign up for, and I realized I didn't know if I would feel comfortable walking into them alone.
Then we'll meet the voice behind one of the catchiest songs to ever come out of the Bay.
There's going to be a generation who's looking back at the history of Bay Area hip-hop music, and then somebody's going to stumble across me and be like, wait a minute, this Michael Marshall, is this the same? Who is this guy? What's the story? And when they start putting together, wait, that guy? Who did that?
What song is it? Find out today on Cross Currents. Every year, more than 25,000 video game developers descend on San Francisco for GDC, the conference where they trade industry secrets, they pitch games they're working on, and they just get to know each other. But in an industry where men make up about 3/4 of the workforce, women are saying the social environment of the conference and its parties doesn't always feel very professional. And some are organizing online to make GDC feel safer and more welcoming for women, non-binary, and trans developers. Mickey Capper reports.
It's Sunday night in SoMa, and the Monarch Club is packed with people sipping drinks, crowding around LCD displays, and clutching Xbox controllers. Partygoers try to get out of the way of a man wearing virtual reality goggles who's swinging his arms around, oblivious to the outside world. The vast majority of the people at the club are men, but there's a cluster of 5 women moving from room to room together, including Zala Habib from New Zealand, and Megan Villablanca from Chicago. They've come from all over for the world's largest game developer conference. They just met today, but tonight they're staying close together.
Whenever I see women, I'm like, nice, like, cool. But then I think about that for a second, and I'm like, I should not be this excited about just seeing another woman. It's like half of the population, yeah.
But at the conference, men outnumber women 4-1, and it can get uncomfortable when those guys get flirty.
Find love if you can find love. I mean, shoot your shot, man. But like, because there is such a large percentage of men and such a small percentage of women in comparison, it can kind of feel almost like an onslaught.
The women here are continuing a conversation that was sparked back in February on Twitter by Emily Grace Buck, a narrative designer for choose-your-own-adventure style games like Batman and The Walking Dead. She remembers the lead-up to her first GDC after she landed her dream job at Telltale Games. Her coworkers started getting excited and making plans for the upcoming conference in San Francisco.
I'd heard about GDC and that it was the biggest game development party of the year.
Buck went to a couple of the official sessions during the daytime, but had heard that the best way to make professional connections at the conference was at night, at the parties. When she got to her first party, though, she was surprised by what she saw.
It was extremely dark. It was smoky. I walked in, and two of the first things I saw were some people making out and somebody popping a pill in their mouth.
She tried to focus on networking, but found it challenging in the middle of a club.
I was standing with 2 other women. The 3 of us were having a very constructive discussion about what to do with our careers, and 2 guys came up and basically started talking at us about how awesome they were. They started asking us if any of us wanted to come party at their hotel. Of course, the answer was no, at which point they, you know, groaned and told us we were ungrateful and walked away.
Buck learned to navigate GDC and similar events with her network of friends from Telltale. But 6 months ago, Telltale Games announced it was shutting down. And when she began planning for GDC this year, she realized she'd be attending largely on her own.
I was starting to look at what parties I could sign up for, and I realized I didn't know if I would feel comfortable walking into them alone.
She decided to voice her concerns on Twitter. Here's an excerpt of that original tweet.
Consenting adults should do whatever they want to do. More power to you. But please, if you ask someone out during GDC and you mean it as a date instead of as a business meeting or friend networking thing, say that. It's fine. But be honest with them so that they can say no if that's not what they want. Don't be tricky and dishonest.
Hundreds of people liked the tweet, and people responded with their own stories.
someone saying, I only went to one GDC and holy smokes, good gracious, thank you. I honestly never considered going back for exactly this issue. Last year at GDC, a dude separated me from my group, said he wanted to show me pictures of his dyed hair from Burning Man, and then accidentally, in quotes, showed me pictures of himself in his underwear and offered to show me photos of him having sex with another woman.
Buck saw that her tweet resonated, so she started a hashtag, #SaferGDC, to encourage people to watch out for each other and encourage men to be more respectful and professional at the conference. In the days that followed, #SaferGDC was used hundreds of times. Game developers of all genders shared their intention to help out anyone in an uncomfortable situation. And Christina Amaya decided to go even further.
We are giving all these women tips, right? And we're trying to help them in those ways, but where is this community that these women can come to?
So she started a Facebook group for women at GDC and initiated a chat on Discord. Now, some guys at the conference, like Felipe Casina, are aware of the issue and sympathize with women who feel uncomfortable.
We should all be able to be at the same level here. We are coming here to learn and network, and it shouldn't be about our bodies.
But Paul Dietman hasn't noticed a problem.
I've never seen any women being like harassed in my environment. So in my reality, I haven't seen this happening.
And Franklin Douglas, who's a first-timer here, he thinks the possibility of romance is par for the course.
You go to a conference, you sit next to a girl, you guys both laugh at the same joke.
That's
it's part of the whole process. You're meeting people who you could potentially work with or someone who you could potentially, you know, be romantically interested in.
General Manager of GDC, Katie Stern, believes she and her team have done a lot to make the conference feel safe and inclusive for all attendees.
We really do want people to feel as though safety is a number one priority for us.
They also offer services to support people across the gender spectrum.
We provide access to childcare, we have mother's rooms, we have gender-neutral restrooms, we have pronoun ribbons so people know how to address each other.
GDC's code of conduct is clear. Unacceptable behaviors include intimidating, harassing, abusive, discriminatory, derogatory, or demeaning conduct by any attendees. But Stern's litmus test is pretty straightforward.
Would you do this in front of your boss in your office? If the answer is no, you probably shouldn't be doing it here either.
And if lines are crossed, Stern encourages attendees to report inappropriate behavior by emailing gdccodeofconduct@ubm.com or by going to the show's management office at Moscone. While the conference does not have oversight over the parties, Stern writes a blog post every year reminding people to stay professional at the nighttime events. The woman who created the SaferGDC hashtag, Emily Buck, she sees respectful behavior at parties as an essential first step to creating a more inclusive gaming culture. Not just for developers, but for players, too.
If we can't even let women and people of other genders enjoy parties, how are we expecting the teams making these games to create experiences that will be friendly to female and more diverse players? We can't. It has to start with the people actually making the thing.
In San Francisco, I'm Mickey Capper for Cross Currents.
The Game Developers Conference is happening this week at San Francisco's Moscone Center. And the conference does include sessions on how to be an ally and how to build diverse and welcoming workplaces. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Tomorrow, filmmaker Jordan Peele's highly anticipated new horror movie, Us, is being released in theaters. The film's trailer has gotten a lot of attention, especially here in the Bay Area, because it features the song I Got Five on it. It was a hit back in the 90s for the Oakland group The Loonies, and that track has become a classic. But the man who sang the memorable hook has remained relatively unknown. Michael Marshall started making music in the mid-80s as a member of Berkeley's Timex Social Club, and then he went on to sing on countless Bay Area rap songs. Marshall tells his story to KELW's Beau Walsh in this edition of Bay Area Beats.
There's going to be a generation who's looking back at the history of Bay Area hip-hop music, and then somebody's going to stumble across me and be like, wait a minute, this Michael Marshall, is this the same guy as Mike Beasley? He's on hella shit. He's on a lot of songs. Who is this guy? What's the story? And when they start putting together, wait, that guy? Is that that guy? Who did that?
Francisco, be sure to wear some flowers in your hair.
Hi, my name is Michael Marshall. I'm an R&B singer from the Bay Area, in particular Berkeley and the San Francisco area. In the 80s, I sang with the Timex Social Club. We did Rumors. 10 years after that, I sang for the Loonies. I did I Got Five on it. And since then, I've been doing solo projects under Michael Marshall, aka Mike Measy. I'm a farmer, and I work for hire. I sing hooks for people all over the world.
Summertime will be a love in there in the streets.
As a youngster, my mother and grandmother were in the choir. And so I was a church kid. I was always there, right? And I was at rehearsal, so at an early age, I heard a lot of music and harmonies and gospel chords. As I got older, I got to sing in the children's choir, which got me used to singing with other voices. And then as I got older, I got into the adult choir, where I learned harmonies and blending, because I really like harmonies. And gospel harmonies are kind of unique, and my ear kind of was drawn to that. After I got into high school, I started hearing Marvin Gaye and a guy named James Ingram. So I kind of patterned myself after that, in the sense of I would sing their songs over and over and over again, to the point where my natural vocal range and inflection and where I would want to go would be reminiscent of those two guys. But when I was in high school and I sang in the first talent show, the very first one was like in the eighth grade. And the only songs I really knew were gospel songs. So I sang a gospel song in a junior high talent show. So they threw batteries at me and they booed me. But that didn't deter me. When I got to the high school the next year, I did a talent show again, but I chose a James Ingram song and I killed it. And from then on, everybody knew that I was a singer, and everybody knew who I was. More so than I knew everybody, a lot of more people knew me. The Timex Social Club came together as an after-school club in high school for DJs. We were mixologists, and there was five of us who hung together real tight. And one of the guys in that mixologist group's name was Marcus Thompson. And Marcus liked to write lyrics. So me and Marcus ended up living together after high school. And I was taking piano lessons at Laney College, and he wrote lyrics, and he had them all over the house. He would like constantly write it in. He wanted to do music, so he built a little sound booth where he had a mic hanging, and he would fool around with a four-track recorder. So one day I was there, and he had some lyrics, and it just so happened that I had a melody that I was playing in the piano class, which was based off of Michael McDonald's I Keep Forgetting, because I was in class trying to play that bass line. So I took that home, and then Marcus had the lyrics, so he helped me make those lyrics fit what I was playing on the keyboard into this four track. And that's how we came up with Rumors. Once the song got out, the Bay Area wasn't playing it for whatever reason. I mean, not for whatever reason. That's the politics here in the Bay. They're not going to play you unless you jump through some hoops or the rest of the world likes you. And that's what happened with Rumors. Rumors got in the hands of a lady named Terry Avery's at K-Day in Houston. She liked it, and she, quote unquote, broke the record. And then it swung from the South all the way back to California. And now they're playing Rumors, and people don't really know that the group is from here, except for all the people who know us from Berkeley High. So that was a big deal. So we played at the Coliseum with Run-DMC, Houdini, LL Cool J, and we opened up. And the place was packed, and we did our thing, and people loved it, and we felt like kings. One of the guys felt so much like a king, he went backstage. Somebody pulled him to the side and was like, "We want to get you guys on the road with us, blah, 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 blah." He signed us up for 15 shows at $2,000 a night. And so we had to go on the road and do that. And the whole tweak about that is that $2,000 was supposed to cover our room and board and transportation and be our payment for our show. The business is whoever has the hottest record is the headliner. Run Them were getting 60, Houdini was getting 30, and LL was getting 15,000 a night. We got two, and they had buses. So we had a little van. We had to drive from every state for 3 months for these 15 shows. Now, what a lot of people were saying back then was, you should be happy that you're on that tour. You guys are new. But that tour, it was fun until it wasn't. It was stressful. I remember having an actual growth growing on my face because I was kind of stressed out, and then I was ready to get back home. Then when we got back home, and after all the cost and everything, and we each got about $1,500. So that was like $100 a show for each one of us. That left a bad taste in my mouth. Your gentle touch is all I desire. After Timex and it started to die down, I was working with a guy named Tone Capone. He knew me from high school, from Berkeley High. He always had rappers from around the Bay he was working with. So he would have those people coming through, and I was looking to make money. So Tone started working with me, and I could do some hooks for some people and get paid. When he started working with the Loonies, Tone called me over at Pacifica. He said, "These kids want to cover this song." Club Nouveau had stole my melodies and used one of them for a song called "Why You Treat Me So Bad." "Why You Treat Me So Bad" is the same music, not lyrics, but music and melody as a song I wrote called "Thinking About You." So Tone called me over and he said, "They want to redo that song. Why don't you play it and then you sing the hook so that you can get some publishing off of that "Why You Treat Me So Bad" that they're not giving you." So when he started working with the Loonies, with Yuck and Numb, I was there, and they have a hook idea, but the cadence of it wasn't matching the time. And it basically is, "I got five on it, grab your 4-0, let's get key. I got five on it, messing with that Mendo weed. I got five on it, it's got me stuck and I'm toe back. I got five on it, player, let's go half on a sack." Most of those lyrics are the Loonies, but the melody and the style is mine. So I took some liberties, and I might have asked them if I could, and I try to clean it up and make it flow a little smoother. Told them when we were doing it, after I finished doing my part and they listening to it and all, I was like, "This is a hit. That particular melody over that music melody and the theme, I got five on it." Because everybody's smoking weed, and what they basically saying is, "We want to get high, but we need like five guys because it's going to cost us $20 to get this gram of weed. So if everybody got five, we can get a gram. So we need four people at least." And that's how people was living back then, pretty much. You'd have to come together to pool your money to get some weed. And that's how people would do it. So they identify with that song. And it was another way of saying smoke weed without saying smoke weed. "I got five on it." He said, "I got five on the time," that kind of thing. It would just turn into a thing, a whole movement. And one night we were listening to Cameo and they played it. And I was like, wow, it's on. It's about to take off. This could be the correction that I wanted. But it turns out the gangsters will be gangsters. They don't really know business. I told them what we needed to do. I told them that Why You Treat Me So Bad, the song they sampled, was actually from Mines. We can copyright this song and say that it was an original melody from this. We don't have to pay these people. They didn't listen to me, and they didn't give me my percentages like they promised they would do. So I got a lawyer and got my 10% that I split with the Tonka Pong. So it's good, but it's not life-changing like all of those got to experience. I was in a crack house one time, and a guy came in, and he was singing I Got Five on It. So then the lady who was there, she's like, you know, that's the dude that sang it. And at the moment, I was like, oh, no, I don't want him to see me in here like this and be like, oh, the guy who sang I Got Five on It. No, but at the same time, it's like, no, that's me. I did that because he don't know who it is. Now he will know who it is. Regardless of what he think about me, just know that guy did that. I'm not the first person to be battling drugs while having a successful music career, but I don't want people to think that my music career was stalled or halted because of something I did while high. After I did my work and what I was supposed to do in my free time, that's what I went and did. So now I turned it to 2 or 3 days, but those 2 or 3 days were not work days. There was nothing that I needed to do. When I did the I Got Five on It, the day that I came over to write that song, I'm sure 2 or 3 days before that I had gotten high. It was just what I was doing. I was trying to not hurt somebody. I mean, it's crazy, but I started hurting myself. Once I got clean and sober, I wanted to get away from the Bay Area, you know, because in a sense, I was feeling like I had pretty much gotten high or was looking for drugs in pretty much all the places in the Bay Area that I would need to be at. And I didn't want to be here with those kind of memories. So I ran for cover in the trees. When I got married, I started doing trim work up north, 1 week off, 1 week on. Because I married into two stepkids, and they would be there 1 week and 1 week off. So it was working, and that paid for, you know, school and college and everything, food and everything. We did good off me going up north and getting into the weed industry as far as a worker. But that turned into a sharecropper thing, where I was learning it and then I was doing it, which turned into me getting my own place, which turns into what I'm doing now. It's just a full-on marijuana farmer. I'm the old man that's got a grudge, chip on his shoulder. My whole life is fighting to get my money back and to get my credit and recognition. And still to this day, people don't know who I am. Still to this day. But they listen and dance and party and write based on stuff that I've done in my 50 years here. So I just do it for the love and hoping that one day one of them will catch. And if I'm not here, I got the business part all down. So I'm going to do what I do. But just give me my due before I die. I'd just like to hear that one time before I die. It's a real bad business, but there are positive parts and positive memories, but most of it is really, really ugly. The positive part is the music and me singing and listening to it later and that kind of thing, but all the other stuff, whack.
That was singer Michael Marshall. His latest album, Grown and Sexy, is available now. That story was produced by KELW's Beau Walsh. And don't forget, you can hear more Bay Area Beats if you just subscribe to the Cross Currents podcast. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts. This music is by Al Harper from San Francisco. They're performing at the Right Spot tomorrow night. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Kristen McCandless, True Quinn, Marissa Ortega-Welsh, Porfirio Rangel, Lisa Wang, and Eli Wertschafter. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.